Spectrum's brought to you by the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University. Before a new idea can become a way of thinking, before one detail can flip the narrative, before anything that matters can change the world, it must, above all, be known. The duty of the Scripps College of Communication is to bring forth the people who bring forth the knowledge, by word or image or data stream and in every medium, and by all means, they succeed. They say, make it loud, make it clear, make it known. Learn more at ohio.edu/Scripps College. Welcome to Spectrum. I'm your host, Tom Hodson. On Spectrum, we cover a wide range of topics. We feature journalists, authors, scholars, policymakers, activists, innovators, and sometimes people with just fascinating stories. Today, we're talking with Dr. Stephen Goldman, a psychiatrist and author. Dr. Goldman has treated and worked with combat veterans and also is a student of the Civil War, Reconstruction, race, and the impact of war itself. His recent book is titled One More War to Fight. It looks into how Union veterans knew after the Civil War that the fight against racism in America was not over and that there was unfinished work to do. Dr. Goldman, you have a new book, One More War to Fight, Union Veterans' Battle for Equality Through Reconstruction, Jim Crow, and the Lost Cause. Long title, but tell us about the book.
It's a book that in many ways is a distillation of my career. And the two main themes of the book, and they're intertwined, and they're both previously untold stories that I think have great resonance for now. The first story is the tremendous political activism of black and white Union veterans for decades after the Civil War, in which they use their survival from the Civil War to change American society by advocating for African-American equality. And it's not a story that's been told in depth previously to what I write and talk about. And secondly, it's paired with the establishment of the paradigm that continues to this day of American veterans returning home and changing society when they come home because, again, they have the gift of survival and they utilize that gift of survival and they're frankly, their radicalization, because war is radicalizing, particularly among those who fight the wars, to change a republic society. And we've got examples literally from the Civil War all the way through now. And of course, you know, Tom, one of the great examples we all lived through from our era was John Kerry and the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And that is exactly the legacy that the men of the Union left.
You're a psychiatrist. You spent a lot of your practice dealing with veterans and veterans' issues. Is that what prompted you to look back historically to the Civil War age?
Yes. Also a lifelong love of the Civil War and the outcomes of the Civil War, including Reconstruction and, tragically, Jim Crow. The material that I have in the book. I've been lecturing on this material for 25 years. And one of the beauties and advantages I had was all the experience I've had both treating and working with veterans, which has been an absolute privilege and throughout my entire career and continue to do. And since I've been lecturing on this for so long and working, frankly, on this book and the others to follow for so long, the material's been tempered by not just my experience, but the feedback I've received from veterans of 20th and 21st century American wars that has been, first of all, so validating And secondly, enabling me to focus on the issues that veterans have when they return. And the third aspect of that is that the media does not do a very good job of giving the full picture of veterans upon their return. They focus almost exclusively on the negative. They do not talk about the tremendous power of the war of identity. They do not focus on the literature that we've had literally since the Civil War of how successful most American veterans have been in civilian life. And this is from a psychiatrist whose entire career has spanned the initiation and the refinement of PTSD as a diagnosis. And certainly I've treated and diagnosed it. But I always say this in my talks, and I will reiterate, that the vast majority of veterans do not experience PTSD. And those who do, in many cases, it is self-limiting. It is not the experience of most veterans to manifest PTSD. And we've got data going back decades on this.
Let's get into the book a little bit. Let's start off, though, with your research. Your research is different on this book than a lot of historians. Talk about how you decided to go about writing this and really how you dug into the research.
Well, first of all, I'm not a historian, and which has been pointed out to me by some in the historical field, some cases positively, some cases negatively. Let me first say, Tom, that the academic rigor of what I've done is no different than what an academic historian would do. I mean, right. as you know, there's more than 1,000 endnotes.
Sure.
However, the predominance of my source material is primary material.
Let's talk to the non-academic world. What does that mean?
That means material that you have from the source themselves. I do not depend greatly on the interpretation or work of people who've come before me. Now, having said that, obviously, folks like Eric Foner, Sandra Manning, and others whose work I do, Keith Harris, whose work was terrific. Obviously, I utilize germane material that's been published before mine, but I don't depend on their interpretation. I don't belong to any historical school, and I bring something different to the table here. First of all, I've treated veterans. That is very different than almost anyone else who's written about this. Having come of age during the Vietnam War is obviously a different orientation, because those of us who lived through that period know how pervasive it was and how it changed views on war. It changes views on serving. And I do find it ironic that someone whose entire family, even though I have a history of veterans in my family, going back to my grandfather who served in World War I, that we protested the war in Vietnam, but thankfully never the men fighting it or the women serving in it. So that I come to it with that perspective, the perspective of what's happened since, and someone, as I say, who's been absolutely privileged to work with men and women who've been to war, who served. And I found something that frankly was out there, but no one had focused on before. And so this book has brand new material, but also a brand new focus on Reconstruction and the years after Reconstruction. Because as you know, the book is told almost exclusively from the viewpoint of black and white Union veterans. That's a very different perspective. And along with that, I try and use as much verbatim material from the veterans themselves, because nobody knows better than they do what the experience was like. I track down all the members of a special cohort, the Left Arm Corps, which I can describe. But I do want to emphasize that the book is not just about the Left Arm Corps. It's about all Union veterans, because I also talk in great depth about the Grand Army of the Republic. And approximately half of all Union veterans were members of the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the most influential veteran organization in American history. That's over 1 million Union veterans, black and white. That's a huge sample. And as I point out throughout the book, I have examples in every chapter of men who had been to war and utilized that experience and how their views had changed on race, on African Americans, on what it meant to go to war, what they had left to fight. And again, this was a second war. And yes, there was violence in this second war, particularly in the chapters I have about the Klan. So it all coalesced in the material that I found that was out there, looking at what's been written previously about reconciliation and Jim Crow and the Lost Cause, but frankly going further than anyone else has because of my focus on the veterans themselves and their political activism. And I found a lot of evidence.
Talk about the Left Armed Corps, if you would.
Sure.
And interpret that for our audience who may never have heard of that.
Yeah, there are an astounding group. And this started with my late dear friend, Dr. John Sellers, who wrote the foreword for the book. The Left Armed Corps derives from the most unique occupational therapy intervention of the early post-Civil War period. William Olin Bourne had served as an unofficial chaplain at Central Park Hospital, which was a tertiary care hospital for men who had lost use of one or more limbs during the Civil War. It was only in existence for 3 years. There's no records, unfortunately, from the hospital itself. But Bourne was so taken with the men to whom he administered at Central Park Hospital, and he had founded a periodical called The Soldier's Friend, designed for Union veterans, that he put together a contest, a national contest, in which men who had lost the use of their right arm or hands to simply learn how to use their left hands for handwriting so that they could become scribes and do work with their left hands. All he asked for in this nationwide contest was a handwriting sample. And he said you could write about patriotic issues if you'd like. 270 men answered with the damnedest essays you've ever seen.
Wow.
They are astounding. And what, in addition to being an incredible resource, as you can imagine, they were also written literally within a few months of the Civil War's ending. So these were not reminiscences decades later. These were written at the time. And Tom, a lot of the men were still in the service. They hadn't even been discharged yet. So you can imagine what a great resource this is.
Yeah.
They're called the Left Arm Corps for obvious reasons. What I have done, now other people have used the material, but not the way I have, because I've performed a lifetime cohort study, which took me years to do.
Now, what does that mean?
I tracked down every man in the collection. All 270, although I had to eliminate three of them. One of them, it was not his right arm. Another one was an imposter, if you can believe it. And a third one I couldn't even find. And I went to the National Archives, which has all their pension records. And I went through all the marvelous online newspaper archives, which are just fantastic now, and found every bit of information I can about these men. And I've got, that's why I've got this book. My next book is the prequel to this book, which is about the Left Arm Corps more specifically during the Civil War. I have a third book about other aspects of their lives throughout the rest of their lives. So, but no one else has done that. They've used excerpts. They've done other things. No one's done a cohort study, and certainly nobody with my training as an epidemiologist, physician, and psychiatrist.
Talk about how the veterans, you talk about the racial binding of the Union Army and the Union soldiers. How did that happen after the war? Did that deteriorate?
No, quite the opposite. As a matter of fact, now bear in mind, let me point two things out. When I first analyzed the left arm core to see if they were a representative sample of white Northern veterans, let me point out that with the exception of two men of color, both from Ohio, two remarkable men in different ways from the 5th USCT, United States Colored Troops, this is as representative a sample of enlisted white soldiers you can find anywhere, 98% enlisted men. And it was a national sample. It was not regimental. I didn't know that until I spent years tracking down all the demographic data to ensure that they were indeed representative. Let me point that out. Now, the change in attitude towards their black comrades did not start after the war. It started during the war. And it is remarkable, something we've seen replicated from war after war. When you serve alongside somebody, color vanishes because the only color that unites you is red. And there were things that happened during the Civil War that backfired on the Confederacy. The first thing that backfired on the Confederacy was the death sentence that was imposed on the white officers of African-American regiments and the imprisonment into slavery, including men who were never enslaved, if they were captured as prisoners. That did nothing but galvanize the bond between black enlisted men and their white officers. The second galvanizing event was the massacre of black, surrendered black troops and their officers under Nathan Bedford Forrest at Fort Pillow. Even white soldiers who had the same racist views as their fellows coming into the war were horrified and outraged at what happened to fellow Union soldiers in blue. Both of those things started to really change attitudes of their fellow white soldiers, not to mention the marvelous performance of black troops. Now, bear in mind, even though black troops fought in segregated units, they fought alongside white soldiers. And they got to know them, in many cases, got to know African Americans as men for the first time in their lives. So the changes in attitude towards African Americans on the part of white Northern soldiers was already starting and building during the Civil War itself. Having survived the war together and having a national veterans organization, the Grand Army of the Republic, that was predominantly from the rank and file, predominantly run by the rank and file, that refused to draw a color line. And as you know, I have an entire chapter on the 1891 historic refusal of the Grand Army Republic to draw a color line, the only national organization that refused to do so, let me point out, in the 19th century in the United States, was indicative of the tremendous respect, admiration, and genuine friendship that developed between white soldiers and African-American soldiers.
You talk about both the white soldiers and the African-American soldiers perceiving the unfinished work of the Civil War, and both of them being committed to trying to finish that work. Compare that, if you would, to the African-American soldiers who were mistreated after World War One, the African-American soldiers who were ignored after World War Two, and even the African-American soldiers who were dismissed after Vietnam. How is all of that different from what you wrote about?
It's not different in some ways, because what happened after World War One, they were treated like human beings in France. You know, because as you know, they served in with the French armies.
Right.
That was one of the agreements that Pershing made. They come back to Jim Crow in the United States, which they vigorously opposed. As you know, there were race riots after World War One.
Right.
World War Two, you had the Tuskegee Airmen. Officers refused admission to officers' clubs, which they vigorously protested. Jackie Robinson was court-martialed, if you remember. Yes. As an officer who refused to go to the back of a bus off base and who was acquitted, what happens by an executive order of Harry Truman? He desegregates the military. Against, by the way, the wishes of most of the military who did not want to desegregate it. So that what happened with the military, which of course now stands as, frankly, a great example of diversity, and where people advance, not obviously not just with race, but with gender and now with sexual orientation, that the military has become, ironically and terrifically, an example of excellence being rewarded, irrespective of background. And I believe that what happened after was a direct, it's like we always talk about standing on the shoulders of those who come before us.
Right.
If the Grand Army of the Republic had not been a biracial organization, if white soldiers had not stood by their black comrades for decades, the rest of the country could have pointed to and said, well, if men who fought with black soldiers don't feel they're equal, why should I feel they're equal? They couldn't say that because national organization made it the point that they couldn't say that. So I think that, and by the way, Carl Melantes, you spoke about Vietnam. Carl Melantes, the great Vietnam veteran writer, pointed out that he thought the roots of an enhancement of the 1960s civil rights movement was not given the acknowledgement of what happened in Vietnam as part of that. Because of the service of black veterans, of black soldiers, in an integrated army, he felt actually a little different than what you were suggesting, Tom. He felt it was an advance. And if you want to look at an example of that, what I think is one of the great films about Nam is Platoon. Take a look at the composition of the platoon. Look at the relationship between those men. And of course, the most beautiful relationship is between, Charlie Sheen's character and his great friend, King, men who had never met in civilian life. One was a white young man in college, and King was from, I believe, Detroit, from inner city. They never would have met in civilian life, but they met in Nam. And there's that beautiful scene where King gets his orders and they say goodbye. Those men could not have been closer.
But they come back.
Don't evaporate.
They come back to two totally different worlds. And that's been consistent since the Civil War, correct?
No, that's not correct. Because since the GI Bill came into existence. And let me ask you this question. Of World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam, which group of veterans had the greatest utilization of the educational benefits?
I would say probably those in Vietnam.
You're the first one who's ever said that. Usually people say World War II. It's actually Nam. Two-thirds of Vietnam veterans utilized the GI Bill educational benefits. And it was about 40 to 45% for World War II in Korea. Who do you think took advantage of that? Groups that had been excluded from particularly the elite schools, who, by the way, did not want the World War II veterans in their schools. Of course, they turned out to be marvelous students.
No, but they were afraid of them.
That's not new either, as I point out. But who did it open up to? Jews, women, African Americans, and now, of course, later Latinos. The GI Bill, educational benefits became a leveler, as education becomes a leveler. And one of the emphases I have in the book is talking about the educational successes of the Freedmen's Bureau and the educational successes that continued after the failure of Reconstruction in the African-American communities, spearheaded, let me point out, in many cases, by African-American Civil War veterans. So, yes, there have been difficulties. Yes, there was discrimination, for example, about getting home loans under the GI Bill, particularly after World War II and Korea. Absolutely. But that doesn't mean there weren't advances made. You know, like I tell my students, because I teach honor seminars at Shepherd University, that history isn't a straight line. You go forward, then you go back, but you never quite return to where you were before. And that's one of the things I try to point out with Reconstruction. Reconstruction ended. It was considered a failure. But we got the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. There was a Civil Rights Act, although later struck down by the Supreme Court. There was other legislation that was utilized. For the first time in American history, African Americans were using the courts, North and South, to desegregate schools, to get opportunities they did not have before. It did not go back completely. And I think that's an important point. The second point I make in the book, and I emphasize in many of my talks, is the impact that Reconstruction had north of the Mason-Dixon line, where it was not technically applicable, as you know, except in the border states. It had a tremendous impact, for example, in Ohio. Ohio's schools got desegregated after the Civil War, decades after the Civil War, and Ohio had black codes on its books, as you know. Does that happen without the Civil War? I doubt it. And one of the examples of that in my book is Robert Pinn, the Medal of Honor awardee from the original 127th Ohio, which became the 5th USCT. He was a remarkable man, the first African-American to be admitted to the bar in Stark County, Ohio. And he's a great example of opportunities that did become available. And by the way, he was a high-ranking official in the Grand Army of the Republic.
We're talking to Dr. Stephen Goldman. We're talking about his book, One More War to Fight. The subtitle is Union Veterans Battle for Equality Through Reconstruction, Jim Crow, and the Lost Cause. Let's talk about the Lost Cause, if we can. Talk about it as a concept, why it was so destructive, and how it exists today.
Well, unfortunately, it still exists today. The Lost Cause started very soon after the Civil War. And it tried to remove the real cause of the Civil War from the Civil War. The
slavery.
Cause of the Civil War was slavery. Full stop. Even though it took the federal government 2 years to actually acknowledge that. And by the way, let me clarify the unfinished work. The unfinished work comes from the Gettysburg Address. When Lincoln referred to the unfinished work in the Gettysburg Address, that was freedom. The unfinished work after the Civil War was equality, and of course remains an unfinished work that we continue to strive towards. The Lost Cause was a way of justifying the formation of the Confederate States of America, of removing slavery as the cause of the war, insisting it was states' rights, and as I point out in very early in the book, that Jefferson Davis's insistence that he was lied to, because he was told that the federal government would not interfere with slavery, and that was a betrayal because slavery got destroyed by the Civil War, which it did. It took hold as an interpretation of the Civil War as the decades from the Civil War went on and Union veterans started to die off in large numbers. Many of them lived to see the Lost Cause take hold as the dominant interpretation of the war, North and South. And we saw that with one of the most despicable films ever made, Birth of a Nation. And if you ever see Gone with the Wind, take a look at the opening explanation of Gone with the Wind before it even starts. It's pure Lost Cause orientation, including hiding the fact that Ashley Wilkes is a member of the Klan. And that interpretation, you know, lasted for decades. You still run into this concept that, you know, deep down, Northern soldiers and Southern soldiers were fighting the same things, which couldn't be more wrong, that Reconstruction was not just a failure, it was a horrible thing to have imposed on the South, which was the historical interpretation for decades, until Eric Foner, in particular, changed that viewpoint, and with other research that came after that. But it became the dominant way of looking at the war. And if you go back and take a look at things, perfect example. Take a look at Buster Keaton's The General, based on a true incident, by the way. He reversed it. The train was stolen by Union soldiers. In his film, he's a Confederate soldier. And if you take a look at the films, things were on television in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. There's very much a pro-Confederate, pro-lost cause interpretation. I mean, it's there. I'm not imagining this. And what's happening now is reevaluation of statues. Now the names of Confederate generals are being removed from army bases and changed. Statues are coming down. People are now looking at what that legacy really meant. And by the way, most of the statues that came up of Confederate soldiers and generals was not after the Civil War. Those were symbols of Jim Crow decades later. And again, my last chapter is devoted exclusively to the placing of a statue of Robert E. Lee, fully clad in his Confederate uniform, in the U.S. Capitol for over 100 years, only removed a few years ago. What does that tell you?
It tells me that we have a lot of work to do.
Well, but the work is there. And I like to think I'm assisting in that. I mean, don't forget, I tell a whole picture here. There's a lot of ugliness in my book. And there's a lot of racism on the part of Northern soldiers. Many of the men who were dedicated to the unfinished work in the first few decades after the Civil War forgot that as time went on, including in a couple of cases, men who had actually served as officers in the United States Colored Troop Regiments. And that's a betrayal. I make that abundantly clear. But I also make clear that there were men until the day they died remained steadfast in the belief that why they had gone to war. And let me say something again about surviving. People generally associate surviving with survivor guilt. Survivor guilt generally morphs into something quite magnificent called survivor obligation. And I mentioned John Kerry before. He wrote a marvelous memoir called Every Day is Extra, in which he specifically talks about the obligation of those who survive war have to those who did not survive and to make their lives dedicated to utilizing their experience with changing their society for the better if they can. This is consistently seen from the Civil War on. And again, Tom, you asked me about using Civil War material.
Right.
I don't just use Civil War material. I use material up until right now because I use literature, psychiatric literature that I'm steeped in, the military literature. And I can tell you that when I present the Civil War material to active duty personnel and recent war veterans, they love the material because it resonates with what they experienced. They're thrilled to see that the men and women who came before them. Because as you know, the military honors those who've come before them. I mean, that's a real part of the ethos within the military. They don't forget. They don't leave anybody behind. These aren't new concepts, but they're embedded in what it means to serve. And let's not forget something else, which was reiterated by the retiring chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, when he made the point directly that in the United States, the military swears an oath to the Constitution of the United States only, not to an individual, not to an administration, not to a president. I took the same oath as a federal employee twice. When you take an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, you become part of something much bigger than yourself. And that is clearly manifested by the men of the Union, because they viewed what they had done during the war as something that had to be carried on after the war. And I think I present very good evidence of that. And frankly, even though a tragic story in many ways, it's also an inspiring story, because that work did continue, and it's our obligation to continue the work that they did begin. And in many cases, even after the war, died for it, because let's not forget, Black veterans were a special target of the Klan, because nothing was more terrifying to the Klan than an educated African-American, particularly one with military experience. Their white Republican supporters were also killed when the attempt was made to register to vote. Certainly during Reconstruction, as we well know, all these things resonate. All these things are issues we still deal with. So what I try very hard to do is to link the past with the present and hopefully the future.
But that leads me to my last question. It's not often that people get to participate in a conversation with an author, even vicariously through me. But I want to ask you, as the author, as the researcher, as the person who's been steeped in this book and in your research, what are the two or three at most things that you would want a reader to take away from this book? What is their takeaway?
That the history of racism in the United States, though tragic, though horrific, is not monolithic. Everybody did not feel the same way in 1865, just like everyone does not feel the same way in 2024. I make it abundantly clear that there was that Black and white Union veterans in great numbers strove mightily to continue the work of equality. That's one thing. The second thing is the work continues. It is our responsibility to continue the work that was begun with the Civil War. The Civil War is the shaping event of U.S. history, and the ramifications continue. But you've got to teach the history completely. It's not one side or another. You have to tell the full story. As I tell the full story of war, war is horrible and destructive. But those who fight wars come back with knowledge about themselves, about their society, that in many ways is quite special. And what I've tried to do and continue to do with this book and others that I hope will come out in the years to come is show that they have a lot to say. That's why I use their words verbatim, because they knew about history. They talked about their role in history. And they, by the way, they related it to their grandfathers who fought in the Revolutionary War. So that I'm trying to have that link there, that there's a lot to learn yet about the Civil War. That Reconstruction's failure didn't make it tragic. That there were things that resulted from Reconstruction that we still utilize. And that you have to see the full picture of what I'm trying to present.
How do people get a hold of your book?
Many ways. They can go to my website.
Which is?
Stephen A. Goldman. That's Stephen with a PH, agoldmanmd.com. And there's a link. And also to other things I've done, including podcasts and talks. Obviously, the publisher is Roman and Littlefield. There's Amazon. There's a lot of other ways to get it. It's available. It's in bookstores. But again, you can start with my website. And by the way, I'm always delighted to hear from folks. And there's a link right there to my email. And I'd love to hear what people think. And it also gives you notice of where I'll be appearing, because I do a lot of talks on this. And as you know me, Tom, for a long time, I love to discuss things. And There's nothing more fun, frankly, than a group of people steeped in this. You know, the audiences, as yourself, Tom, the audiences I've had through this, and also not just here, but the last 25 years, people are really knowledgeable. And that's a lot of fun, too. You know, they challenge you. Civil War people in particular, you got to get the details right.
Right.
You know, God help you if you get one of the details wrong. But that's cool. That's fine. And again, one of the most gratifying things continues to be I get so many veterans coming. And you can imagine having them in the audience is so terrific. And, you know, it enhances all this.
Again, it is Stephen A. Goldman, MD, all one word, all lowercase, .com. Yes,
that's correct.
You can go there and learn more about speaking engagements as well as background on Dr. Goldman and a lot about this book. Dr. Goldman, as always, thank you. We can't wait for the prequel so that we can get together and talk again.
I'd be delighted, as you well know. And thanks so much for having me on.
Today, we've been talking with psychiatrist and author Dr. Stephen Goldman. His book, One More War to Fight, gives us insight into the bonds between Civil War veterans and their commitment to the unfinished business facing America after the war. Spectrum is produced by WOUB Public Media. Adam Rich is our co-producer. I'm your host, Tom Hodson. Please subscribe to Spectrum. You can do that at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or at NPR One. Spectrum also is available through the NPR Podcast Directory. We always welcome your feedback, so please rate our podcast or review it through one of your favorite podcast outlets. If you have questions or comments about our podcast or have suggested topics for us to cover, please direct them to me by email. You can do that at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu.